Good evening and welcome. This is the formal welcome to the retreat. And I have a sense in this capacity of sitting up here, of being a Dharma teacher, sitting on the teaching platform. I have occasionally the wonderful invitation to also speak for the Dharma. And so as a public representative of the Dharma, duly appointed, the Dharma welcomes you here. In the Dharma, you all belong. You're all part of this, no matter what your circumstances are. You equally belong in the Dharma. You're welcomed here in this field. Thank you for being here. So now, little bit, I'll take that hat off. So, a few things, a few announcements still. Just in terms of practice discussions for this retreat. So tomorrow we won't have any. It's pretty common for the first day. And kind of settling in. And then I'll see a third of you each day. And we'll do a 10-minute inter-practice discussion, which is standard for this retreat. And you might seem like too short. But generally, as this kind of long retreat goes along, it's sometimes more than enough. And so it'll work itself out. And so what it means is that if everything goes, you know, as planned, without the needs from my mother, I'll see you every third day. It just rolls through the retreat. There might be a day off here on some weekend or something. And then for the most part, that's the way it's going to work. And then the plan is I'll give all the talks, unless, again, I have to go away, except for the last talk Inez will give. And the way we'll do the practice discussions is you'll just be assigned. I think it works easier if I just assign them rather than the sign-up system. So you know, I'll just have a sheet of paper that I'll post it with times and your name and hopefully that'll be harmonious enough. I'll pay attention to the work meditation times and bell ringing times, and hopefully it'll all be nice. And if you've never been a bell ringer before, or if you have been a bell ringer before, the schedule has changed. So don't come up here out of old habit thinking you know the schedule from previous retreats. There is up here these white sheets of paper with the schedule. And my request of you is that even if you think you know really well, you've memorized the schedule, you recite it to yourself every morning, or whatever, look at it the first day. Just think of it as a ritual of observation. Just make sure you have the right time. And then, because it's pretty common for people to, some sittings are 30 minutes, some 45, some the ones I think 35. And so just have to kind of make sure that you know. And if you've never rung this bell up here before, you might want to come during a break and just try ringing it, because it's fairly common. People never done it before, they ring it too hard the first time. It's just you know it's very sensitive bell, so you're not really hitting it hard, but the bell allows itself to be, I don't know what to call it, it receives it hard. So and then you can sit either in the chair or sit here for being the bell ringer. So and that's my seat there. I think that's my seat. Right? No one's claimed that one, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, that's my seat. When I'm not up here. And that's Inez's seat behind Joe. So I think that's logistically the things to say. So then to begin with the Dharma teaching of this retreat, a bit of an introduction, the foundation for it, and I'm going to be fairly vague about what the theme is. I've called it the insight journey, but only because Inez kind of pushed me to have one. So the insight journey. So as an introduction to it, I want to say that there's been times when I've considered the Eightfold Path and thought that various things should be added as the ninth fold of the path. But the most common thought that I've had about what should be the ninth of the Ninefold Path that should be added to it is right relationship. Until I thought, that's what the whole thing is about. So it doesn't, the Eightfold Path is about right relationship. And it doesn't take a lot of analysis to go through each of the factors of the Eightfold Path and see that they're relational in nature. And some are really obvious, like on the ones in the middle of speech and action and livelihood. But you can kind of see all of them have to do with the relationship to others, relationship to ourselves, relationship to suffering. And it's useful to think about it, that we're coming into a right relationship. The word right is problematic for some English speakers. The word sama, the first Pali English Dictionary definition of it, or entry for it, is thorough. And sometimes they also have complete. They have so there's other words besides right, and sometimes it is the whole path, the right and the whole, or the complete, or. And the etymology of the word, which may not be relevant by the time of the Buddha, but going back into more ancient India, meant something like to move in a direction, to incline or to bend something in a certain direction. And that's kind of lost in the Pali, but in the etymology of it. But what's the thorough direction to go? Or what's the direction to go to be thorough? What's the direction to go to be complete or to be whole? And this idea of including everything is a kind of, I think, a marvelous way of thinking about practice. But it isn't so much that the idea of including everything in some, I don't know, metaphysical way or something, but what the key thing is, our relationship to everything. And that's where the core of the practice is, what that relationship is. And as some of you know, there's sometimes in English this idea of, or in circles, that there's me, there's you, and there's we. That once you have people coming together, you have something else that's created that is was different than the individual, different than the two individuals separately, but something happens in that relationship, in that interaction that exists in a certain kind of way that sometimes needs to be respected and understood and discussed and honored, celebrated, or all kinds of things. And so there's something very special that happens in relationships. And so if we suffer, and suffering is because of we're clinging to something, that clinging is a kind of a relationship. We're in relationship to something where we're grasping it. And those that might be ideas and feelings, things that are inside of ourselves, but we're in relationship to those things inside of ourselves. And as we do this practice, we are shifting that relationship, the relationship, what we're contributing in terms of the relationship. And the primary way that this tradition, ancient tradition, talks about it is mostly what we're doing is letting go of clinging, grasping, craving. It's mostly about what we don't do. And it's a little bit frustrating for some people who want to have celebrate the positive. But the advantage of letting go of what gets in the way, the obstructions to something, is that then what wants to be born inside of us, what wants to arise, can arise without limitation of some expectation of what it's supposed to look like. So if we say, well, if we let go of our obstructions, our clinging, then we have this relationship of loving everything. But that's kind of a high bar. And then we measure ourselves against that. Am I loving enough? And this, But if we don't, maybe we don't have to say. We just trust what's here. If there's no clinging, no grasping, all the evil, all the terrible things people do to each other, especially when it's unconsciously or intentionally, or arises out of these some form of attachment, some clinging and grasping. And it's a pretty marvelous thing to shift that and come into right relationship with things. A relationship shifts and changes. So we're looking for that right relationship, that whole relationship that inclines towards being free in relationship to everything. What this means in terms of practice on retreat is that we're not looking for some wonderful experience. We're not measuring the retreat by how free of pain you are, or how much pain you are, or physical pain you have, or how busy your mind is, or how you're caught up in your preoccupations, or whatever, or how free you are, what level of concentration you're in. All the above can happen on retreat, and some of it is something we want to cultivate, perhaps to some degree. But what the key of it, the foundation of the whole thing, is what is that relationship you have to it? And if you have something that's unfortunate happening, that you're having the same mental rumination over and over again, the issue of practice is not that you're doing that. The issue in practice is, what is your relationship to it? Do you contract? Do you get narrower? Do you get resistance? Do you get aversive? Do you get afraid? Do you get, how are you relating to it? And once you see that very clearly, just seeing it, what shifts? Just seeing it is a beginning of a new relationship. To see it and want to get rid of it, that's maybe not the right relationship. That's not that's, that doesn't, it doesn't fit into really so well into the Eightfold Path, I would suggest. Because to have aversion to something, to want to, expel it or reject it, or to hold on to it or keep it for yourself or something, those are all things where freedom is not found. So look at, where's the freedom in the midst of whatever is happening, no matter how unfortunate it might be? What it means here on the retreat is that no matter what happens on the retreat, the real issue here is not whether or not it's happening, but how you practice with it, how you work your relationship with it and look at it and try to come to a better, healthier relationship with it, and you're going to find that way. So in a sense, whatever happens becomes the Dharma, becomes the practice. So if the meal is an hour late, guess what? That just means that there's a new practice opportunity. There's no need to write a letter to the managing director and say, I can't believe the meal is late. It just means that you practice with that. Maybe you're more hungry than you want to be in. You get to practice with that. So that's the default. It can be taken too far, that attitude, that approach, but that's kind of the default. What's the relationship you have? And as we settle into this, and as that relationships begin to shift, and some we get more sensitive to it, we start seeing this amazing thing that it's a two-way communication. That it's a, there's a kind of a we that happens here. That's there's reality, there's you, and in a certain kind of way, reality is contributing to that relationship. It's providing information. I mean, if it's another person, they provide more than information, maybe. But it's a reciprocated thing in a certain kind of way. And so it's difficult to kind of, at some point, to think it's all about your relationship to that, whatever is happening. But somehow there's a co-creation happening. There's a kind of a coming together so that your relationship to what is happening, if your relationship to depends a little bit on what seems to be coming from the thing, the nature of it, the flow of it. And so maybe one meal has the perfect amount of salt and the other one has too much salt. But maybe it's sometimes the meals, the recipes are repeated here at IRC. I don't know what they're planning for the three-week retreat, but two-week retreat they have the change, but I don't know if we're going to repeat something. But if we repeat it, it might be that it's next time it's something a little different. And so you're receiving information that's different from the second meal. And so your relationship to that might change. And your relationship to it might change differently on the first week than the third week, depending on different factors in you. There's all these infinite factors that come into play that are informing that relationship. And it's not just you in your kind of usual sense of agency and you're the one who's responsible that's involved. The magic of it is that there's something more at play here in this kind of invisible world of relationship, of relatedness. And so to discover, to kind of tune in to the relatedness, the relationship, that what arises. And there's one little paraphrasing or rewording of a teaching I'd like to offer you, that to assert the self is delusion. To be informed by all things is awakening. To assert the self is delusion, but to be informed by all things is awakening. And this thing of all things includes what's in you and yourself, your history, and all that you bring and who you are, and all the what's around you, your situation. To let all that very respectfully and lovingly be allowed to inform the situation, informs that relationship. And at some point, the idea of a kind of self-understanding, where we assert ourselves or pull ourselves back or defend ourselves or explain ourselves or all this kind of self game we play recedes from importance. And what becomes most alive and delightful is the relatedness of it all, the relationship there. And the analogy I'd like to offer is maybe it's like riding a bicycle. That might be hard to learn to ride the bike, but once you learn to ride the bicycle, there's so many things that you become second nature, but there's so many things that go into riding a bicycle, especially if you're doing mountain biking or busy streets or something, and you're navigating so many different things. And it's in the relationship to the street and the traffic and the potholes and your energy level and the hills and this block, all that is information that comes together that includes you. And it can be a delight to be in that whole dynamic world of that. And in fact, part of the delight is that it can be a relief from just living in the self, self-concern, self-preoccupations about me, myself, and mine. So this world of relatedness, of how, what's the relationship you have, and as you, that you're offering, that you're contributing, how are you relating to this? And then what is that relationship? And what is the information that's coming together here? And what am I responding to? What am I offering? What's, until maybe it's the I falls away. It's just this dynamic, wonderful way in which things are moving through us, and in a sense are flowing or occurring, that is free of clinging, of attachment. So that's, so one of the things I'm trying to get across in this talk is that to support you on this retreat is don't be so concerned about what's happening. Be mindful of how you're relating to what's happening. And that's one of the real big keys to find your way through this practice that we're doing. So that was the introduction to kind of then, you know, this idea of the insight theme that we'll do for the retreat. And I'm going to offer a variety of different elements of the journey, the path of insight practice. And it'll be kind of presented with the idea of a path, but don't be fooled by the fact that it's kind of a linear path. It's more like a spiral, maybe. And even the person who's the rawest beginner of all this can probably find themselves, if you know, through the whole path, one cycle around, and then someone a little bit more, has a little different perspective each time you go around the spiral. So hopefully that how I'll present this, you don't have to be anywhere except where you're at. You can just, where you're at is fine. You don't have to, because that's, again, what's important is not where you are on a path. What's important is your relationship to what's actually happening, and including what I'm teaching. You know, and if you relate to it in any kind of way, whether it's clinging or I'm not good enough or I'm better, then guess what? That's you've complicated the relationship to it all. Keep it simple. Keep it simple, and maybe try to find yourself in these teachings, in your way, to what resonates and fits for you, rather than some idea that it's a foreign thing. Some of the things I'm going to talk about. Hopefully, that'll work for you. So the rhythm of the talks will be little sub-themes of three things, three talks, and then next three talks, and next three talks. So the kind of rhythm of these triads that's going to happen. And the first ones will be about kind of the foundational aspects of insight practice, or meditation practice as taught by the Buddha, the three qualities that is kind of maybe most important that he gives at the beginning of practice. And then there's the three things that, using those attentional faculties, what we're trying to develop. And then the three insights that are important for this tradition. And then the three mental states that somehow get born out of those insights. And then the three ways in which the attention to the world shifts with these new states. And then as the attentional capacity shifts in a new way, how they support the practice going forward from that. And also in three ways. So that's more or less the plan, and that was intentionally left vague. And so you don't know, you know, it'll all be revealed as we go along here. Just kind of go along for the ride, I hope. So so hopefully that worked okay for an introduction. And then I'll turn it over to Inez and for the refuges and precepts.
So I'd like to say a few words before I do the refuges and precepts. You know, following Gil's example of the kind of things that happen where, you know, the meal's an hour late. At the end of a 3-month retreat, that it was that, you know, for the very last day, they had two separate lunches, you know, they were like half an hour apart. So they put it up on the board, you know, A through J, you know, at 12, and M through Z at 12:30, and they kind of left out, you know, K and L, you know. So one of the yogis put down K and L and circled and put equanimity practice. So that's what I wanted to say, a few words about this very, very important factor of equanimity that we develop as we practice. You know, the balanced mind, the evenness of mind, a mind that stays open and clear regardless if we get what we want or don't get what we don't want. So it's a factor that gradually develops. But one aspect that I think sometimes equanimity is a high bar, you know, you're stuck in the middle of a struggle and going, yeah, be equanimous, yeah. One teacher used to say over and over, be equanimous, you know, you just want to hit them, you know. So, you know, the word that I use sometimes, you know, is flexibility. And especially at the beginning of a retreat for me, you know, when the mind isn't so balanced and spacious, you know, a simple way to define flexibility is the willingness to change easily. You know, so yeah, so lunch is late. Okay, you know, to adapt what shows up in our lives. It's really special that we've all devoted the next 3 weeks for practice to set aside everything else in our lives. It speaks to how valuable, how important the Dharma is to us. And so with flexibility, we can approach this retreat, you know, with sometimes it calls on us to approach with the heart of a warrior, you know, strong and persevering and unshakable. And at other times, it calls for us to be soft and warm, like a mother with a newborn child, loving and caring. And so these different ways of, you know, one moment we're this way, another moment we're that way, but really allowing the flexibility. And lastly, one other thing that, you know, Gil reminded me of was, you know, people talk about, oh yeah, there should be a ninth step to the Eightfold Path. Well, the ninth step my husband always, you know, always brought up was right humor. And so I just want to finish this piece with just, it's just as essential as any other part of the path, really. This, as Suzuki Roshi said, and maybe some of you who've been wandering around the center have noticed it on the kitchen, I think it's in the kitchen, what we're doing here is so important, we better not take it too seriously. You know, and so this is the attitude of flexibility that I want to, you know, bring to this retreat. So as you know, we traditionally begin our retreats with taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and then taking the five precepts together. I'd like to begin with a passage from Dhammapada. People threatened by fear go to many refuges, to mountains, to forests, parks, trees, and shrines. None of these is a secure refuge. None is a supreme refuge. not by going to such a refuge is one released from all suffering. But when someone going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha sees with right insight the Four Noble Truths, suffering, the arising of suffering, the overcoming of suffering, and the Eightfold Path leading to the ending of suffering, then this is the secure refuge. This is the supreme refuge. By going to such a refuge, one is released from all suffering. Refuge can mean finding shelter and protection. Not the safety we find with a roof over our heads or food to sustain us, but the deeper safety in our own hearts. I like to remember that taking refuge is a ritual that has been done for over 2,000 years by countless and countless of practitioners have done this. But what makes the difference between a living ritual and an empty ritual? It's our presence. I invite you to connect with this lineage of past practitioners and current practitioners throughout the world, throughout the globe, some of them on the online retreat, to connect with all of us together to this deep commitment to awakening. And we'll take refuge in the Buddha, a very wise person who awakened and became free. We can take refuge in the potential for awakening and potential for compassion found in each one of us. We can take refuge in the Dhamma, in the teachings of the Buddha, this beautiful Eightfold Path that frees our hearts from entanglement. And we take refuge in the Sangha, the wonderful community of sincere practitioners. Those of us here, those of us everywhere. Those of us, all beings everywhere whose kindness and compassion support us. So we'll begin in Pali. We're going to, with an expression of homage or respect to the Buddha. And we'll do it three times. We'll do it call and response. It basically means homage to the Buddha, the worthy one, the rightly self-awakened one. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhassa So we'll now chant the three refuges in Pali, again, three times, call and response. And it means I go to the Buddha for refuge, I go to the Dhamma for refuge, and I go to the Sangha for refuge. Buddham saranam gacchami.
Buddham saranam gacchami.
Dhammam saranam gacchami.
Dhammam saranam gacchami. gacchami.
Sangam saranam gacchami.
Saranam gacchami.
Dutiyampi.
Dutiyampi.
Buddham saranam gacchami.
Buddham saranam gacchami.
Dutiyampi.
Dutiyampi.
Dhammam saranam gacchami.
Dhammam saranam gacchami.
Dutiyampi.
Dutiyampi.
Sangam saranam gacchami.
Sangam saranam gacchami.
Tatiyampi.
Tatiyampi.
Buddham saranam gacchami.
Buddham saranam gacchami.
Tatiyampi.
Tatiyampi.
Dhammam saranam gacchami.
Dhammam saranam gacchami.
Tatiyampi.
Tatiyampi.
Sangam saranam gacchami.
Sangam saranam gacchami.
An important part of taking refuge is taking refuge in our own goodness, in our dedication to not cause harm. The five precepts can be seen as guidelines or reference points that make it clear to us when our choices might cause harm, either to ourselves or to others. They help us align ourselves with our deepest aspiration towards freedom. The more aligned we are in not causing harm, the deeper is our sense of self-integrity. This integrity fosters a deep sense of trust, of confidence in ourselves. When all our actions of body, speech, and thought, when they're based on kindness and compassion, it naturally increases our ability to be happy and to be at ease. By agreeing to these five precepts, we also help create a safe container for all of us sitting this retreat together. All of us are devoted to not causing harm. All of us are devoted to helping each other be free. This commitment, you know, those of you, you know, most of you have done this so many times in past retreats, you know, made this commitment and made this commitment in your lives. And it grows and deepens. It can, over the years, we can connect with it in more subtle ways, more refined and subtle ways. So allow these five precepts to just deepen just a little bit more within you. Just a little bit more. So the five precepts are to refrain from taking lives. I like to include to act with reverence to all forms of life. This connects us, connects me with my heartfelt wish to treat all living beings with care. The second precept is to refrain from taking that which is not given. I like to include appreciating what we receive. And we receive a lot. To refrain from sexual misconduct is the third. And for this retreat, it means not participating in any sexual activity. At other times, it means taking care with our sexual energy and not causing harm with it. The fourth is to refrain from lying and to speak truthfully. For this retreat, it means maintaining noble silence, only speaking when it's necessary to do so. For some of you on Zoom, you know, who live with others, it might look a little bit different. So it's helpful to remember that it's more important to be kind than to be 100% silent. And I also like to consider here to include our own inner voice, to speak kindly and truthfully to ourselves. Right relationship. And the last one, the fifth one, is to refrain from intoxicants that cloud the mind. These days, I think it's important to include the internet and our devices as common intoxicants. So if for those of you that might be tempted by your devices, it might be helpful if you think of them as, hey, this is time to practice with the fifth precept. That addictive quality that keeps us from having a clear mind. So we ask you to verbally agree to these five precepts for the duration of this retreat. And we're doing this for ourselves and for each other. So I will speak the precepts, so please repeat after me. For the duration of this retreat,
I agree to refrain
from taking life and to act with reverence,
for all forms of life.
I agree to refrain from taking that which is not given.
I agree to refrain from sexual activity.
I agree to maintain noble silence and to only speak when necessary.
I agree to refrain from intoxicants.
So silence begins now. Feel free to go to bed early, have a cup of tea, walking meditation, continue practicing in the hall, whatever supports your practice. So I wish you sweet dreams whenever you go to sleep. Good night.